Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Amber Monk with Greenberg Traurig. My bar number is 39531. I am counsel for Appellants Air Ambulance Specialists, Inc. and Emergency Medical Services Corp. Your Honors, the cost statute does not guarantee a prevailing party the right to automatically shift all costs the other side. It only guarantees recovery of those costs that are reasonably necessary to the party's case without, in the words of this court in Clayton v. Snow, the squandering of an adversary's resources. Plaintiff's recovery here exceeded that balance. The issue before this court today is whether plaintiffs submitted sufficient evidence to warrant the trial court shifting of all expert witness expenses, copying costs, and deposition transcription fees to the defendants and appellants. Appellants respectfully request that this court reverse the lower court's opinion on the bill of costs and remand to the district court to recalculate by reducing the award by $66,000 and more, actually, for three reasons. First, Air Ambulance has been charged for the costs for all expert witness expenses, including expenses for eight assistants by the testifying expert, and for consulting.
Did you challenge the recovery of the non-testifying experts, of the assistants to the experts below? And if so, can you tell me where you challenged that?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue was raised during the evidentiary hearing at record 3713. It's page 129 in the hearing transcript. In the actual response to the bill of costs,
and you weren't challenging the reasonableness, you were challenging per se that they were the assistance of the expert.
Your Honor, in the briefing in the response to the bill of costs, the issue was couched in the form of, was it reasonable and necessary? In the oral argument in the transcript, it was specifically the preparation of her report and rebuttal report, we agree, was reasonable and necessary for purposes of our expert costs. Now, having many additional individuals working on that, on the report and the rebuttal report, is another issue. That was the quote from that page in the record. In addition to the issue as to the eight assistants, a second issue on the expert fees is the work requested and ordered to be reimbursed that was consulting work performed by both the testifying expert and her assistants. Second, Air Ambulance has been charged with every cent for every copy made by plaintiff at an unreasonably high in-house copy rate in contravention to this court's opinion in Valentine, with which I know Judge Jones is very familiar, having authored that opinion, applying a 6-cent copy charge, which was acknowledged as reasonable by plaintiff's own witness in the evidentiary hearing, would result here in an overcharge of $5,000. Third, Air Ambulance has paid for all costs relating to every deposition noticed in this case, including the defense by plaintiffs of three witnesses whom plaintiffs necessarily controlled in terms of the perpetuation of testimony and in terms of appearance at trial. Those three witnesses were the plaintiffs themselves and their paid expert. The charge for those three transcripts is $1,300. We understand, Your Honor, that the trial court is afforded discretion in determining whether fees are reasonable and necessary. And the standard of review here is an abuse of discretion. We submit that the trial court did, in fact, abuse his discretion. And let me talk in more detail with respect to a couple of these points. As to the assistant point, which Your Honor, Judge Roman referenced, Ms. Melinda Harper was the testifying expert here. She used 8 assistants who collectively billed 210 hours for a collective cost of $36,000. Their time isn't recoverable under the plain language of the statute. That statute, 13-33-102, subsection 4, provides for recovery for witnesses, quote, called to testify only to an opinion founded on special study or experience. None of these 8 assistants were called to testify. None of these 8 assistants were identified in disclosures as potential experts, and there was never any plan that they testify. Their time also isn't recoverable under Perkins and Western Fire Truck. We identified those in our papers, both of which preclude recovery to assistants. And Your Honors, their time also isn't recoverable as a matter of policy. Plaintiff's argument in their response is that Ms. Roper's time, and Ms. Roper billed 136 hours, that her time is recoverable under the statute because even though she didn't sign the report, quote, her scientific experience as a CPA and MBA went into the generation of the report for Ms. Harper. The question isn't who drafted the report, although I'll get to that. The question is who testified. Ms. Roper did not testify. As to who drafted the report, I think the deeper concern here is that what plaintiffs describe and the process that they want this court to approve is a process that undermines the endorsed expert schema. It usurps the role of the testifying expert. We have a case where 8 individuals, Ms. Roper being the key one, were not endorsed. Their interactions with counsel were shielded from discovery. They were not deposed. They did not sit at trial. The jury did not have the opportunity to evaluate their credibility, their expertise. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, 2 of my colleagues sitting to my left are actually both familiar with the Valentine case, having participated in that. Tell me, having reviewed the Valentine case, and I know that down below it was argued extensively in front of the trial court judge as well, how this case differs from that case in terms of what they're seeking here.
In the Valentine case, number one, on appeal, the issue was not raised as to assistance. So the Valentine case did not speak to assistance, Your Honor. In addition, the Valentine case had an expert, in addition to the testifying expert, sit before the trial court and opine as to the reasonableness of Ms. Harper's fees. She was the one at issue in the Valentine case. We did not have the benefit of an additional expert who examined all of the work that was performed and testify about the reasonableness of that work. Only Ms. Harper sat on the stand, and the type of work that she discussed having been done by her and her team also raises the concern of a consulting hat versus a testifying expert hat. We have a number of billing hours, and the plaintiff's brief references individuals who assisted in preparing cross-examination materials, not just of the defendant's experts, but of the defendant's CFO and other lay witnesses. We had, dozens of hours billed to preparing demonstratives. We have hours billed to looking at discovery, organizing discovery, assisting with motions to compel. This is the type of work that if plaintiffs want to have performed by an expert, they have that choice. But that choice comes with a price, and the price is they cannot force their adversary to pay for those charges. Let me quickly, because I'm going to try to reserve for myself about 2 hours of, or I'm sorry,
2 hours.
I would love 2 hours, but I'll do my best to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The second argument in our brief relates to copying costs. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because I can't, and because I think it's fairly straightforward. Your Honor, Judge Jones and Valentine, you made it clear It is unreasonable for council to undertake large copying, photocopying jobs in-house rather than outsourcing them at a reduced cost. Here, or I should say in Valentine, this court recognized that outside vendors in Denver charged 5.5 cents in 2009, of course. In this case, the record demonstrates that the outside vendor actually used by plaintiff charged 8 cents per page for standard copies. And this is in the record at 1931. The evidence at the hearing further demonstrated that fees from other vendors in Denver ranged as low as 4 cents for a standard copy. Plaintiff's own witness, Shea Thurman, testified during the hearing that outside vendor charges started at about 6 cents.
Well, counsel, sometimes it isn't practical to go to outside vendors. I mean, you may have a number of small jobs over a period of time that add up. It's not like it's one big job that it really makes sense to send out. Isn't that what we have here, just kind of a bunch of relatively small jobs over a long period of time?
Your Honor, to answer your question, yes, on occasion you need to print in-house by virtue of the emergency circumstances or just, you know, you have a two-page document that you send to printing. Here, there is no real distinguishing between matters that needed to be sent out and matters that were copied in-house. Virtually everything was copied in-house. Of the 26,000 pages of copies, 20,000 of them were in-house copies. And many of those copies were not for small one or two page copy jobs, Your Honor. And we've identified in the record at 1972 a list of some of these copy jobs. We have 2,000 pages for discovery pleadings, 5,000 pages for working copies, 5,900 pages for trial, 3,000 pages for trial exhibits, although plaintiffs also sent out for outside copying exhibit binders. And we submit that never differentiating between when it's reasonable for in-house and when it's not reasonable is not acceptable. And they ought not be entitled to recover for making every copy in-house.
All right, let's go back. I know you have limited time. I want to go back to the expert issue because that's where most of the money is, right?
That is $60,000.
Right. And a big part of that is assistance. And were we to say that you cannot recover for assistance, wouldn't the net result of that be that simply the experts themselves spend more time at a higher hourly rate and end up billing for that time, and then even more costs are shifted to the losing party?
I think Your Honor raises a good point and an interesting point. I think on occasion some of the work may be then incurred by the actual expert performing the underlying analysis herself. On the other hand, I think that's appropriate. She's the one sitting on the stand and the one the jury sees. In addition to that, however, I think there might be a call made as to what actually is reasonable. In this case, we have a collective amount billed of around 200 hours in the final weeks of trial. In my estimation, 200 hours is not reasonable. If one individual was sitting for that, you know, was the only one permitted to actually perform that work, they would not and could not bill 200 hours. They would bill what is appropriate for trial preparation. Let me see how quickly I can do deposition charges. Our position in the brief is that depositions are recoverable only when taken for the perpetuation of testimony. The deposition charges at issue here were for defending the depositions, so strike one. Strike two, not for the perpetuation of testimony. They controlled these witnesses. None of their deposition transcripts were actually used in a pleading.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Looks like in your brief you're objecting to the costs for the depositions of the plaintiffs, which you noticed. Okay, so you took those depositions. So why aren't they entitled to get transcripts of those to prepare for trial? And then, should they win, shift the cost onto your client?
because the language in the statute doesn't provide for it, and because they control those witnesses. They could call them up and ask them.
Well, they control them, but any prudent lawyer is going to want to get a transcript of that deposition to prepare the witness for trial testimony and for cross-examination. So, I mean, just analytically, I'm thinking in terms of costs necessary and reasonable to prepare for trial, how are these depositions different than the depositions of other witnesses?
And the distinction that we've drawn, and I know I'm out of time, Your Honor, so I'll try to respond to your question.
You are never out of time when you're answering one of our questions.
Well, then let me speak. No, the distinction that we're drawing and the distinction written into the actual language in the statute is a deposition that you take is typically one where you do not control that witness's testimony, and this is the only way in which you are provided an opportunity to perpetuate that testimony. A deposition that you defend is typically a deposition where you control the witness. You do not need their deposition testimony in order to ensure perpetuation of that testimony, either for use in pleadings or at trial. That's especially clear here, where the witnesses were the plaintiffs themselves and their paid expert.
But don't you need them to prepare for trial? Because if I'm counsel representing the plaintiffs, I now know what questions I'm likely to hear at trial for my clients. That's going to help me prepare them for trial. Again, I'm just not seeing how that's not a necessary cost of preparing them. It seems to me it would be irresponsible, bordering on malpractice, not to get a copy of those transcripts and prepare them based on those transcripts.
Your Honor, I recognize as an attorney that what we frequently do is ask for the transcript. When you're sitting at the deposition as the attorney, in theory, having sat through the deposition, you know the questions that are being asked because you're sitting at the deposition. You also know the testimony that your own witness is going to discuss at trial because they are your witness. And you can ask them questions and you can fact investigate them all day long before trial. That's the distinction. And I understand the tension that Your Honor has identified in terms of what counsel typically do. Here we're just talking about what's reasonable and necessary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I'm going to make things more difficult for the bailiff. I will allow Ms. Monk to have 2 minutes of rebuttal time. I will allow appellees to have 18 minutes on their response argument.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Chelsea Burns. My bar number is 38068. With me today is John Lipsack. We're from the law firm of White & Steele, and we represent the plaintiffs in this matter, Donald and Kim Marie Jones. As your honors have heard, this appeal is all about three types of costs, all three of which are enumerated as recoverable by a prevailing party in CRS 1316.122, and all three of which were analyzed in the Valentin case, which we have been discussing. I'll talk about each of those three and address the defendant's arguments on each of those items. But first, I think it's key to remember that there has been absolutely no evidence here of an abuse of discretion. The trial court's well-reasoned award of costs to the plaintiffs was based on ample evidence, including a 5-hour hearing on the bill of costs. In addition, there was extensive briefing and voluminous documentation provided by the plaintiffs to support each dollar that the trial court awarded. And looking at proportionality, the trial court awarded approximately $115,000 to the plaintiffs after they prevailed on a 5-day jury trial in which they were awarded over $1.5 million on their breach of contract claims against the defendants, a multi-billion-dollar corporation. Again, there's been no evidence of an abuse of discretion. The primary issue here is the approximately $90,000 that the trial court awarded for the plaintiff's expert fees. Again, this is an enumerated cost item in 1316.122 subsection E.
Counsel, let's get right to the heart of that issue, which seems to be the amounts charged for the assistants, who themselves are not the expert. So there's nothing expressly enumerated in the statute for assistants of experts. So what's the legal authority for recovery of those costs?
The legal authority is that in that statute in subsection E, it said all costs for experts. It does not make a distinction. The statute that the defendants are relying upon, 1333.102, is not the statute that is at issue in this case. And those cases that determined that the fees for assistance were not recoverable were decided pursuant to that other statute, 1333.102. It's not applicable here. And in the Valentine case, if you look at pages 57 to 58 of the hearing transcript, Melinda Harper testified that in Valentine, 100% of her fees were awarded. And those fees included multiple billing entries on her invoices for other members of her firm. And as we pointed out, these were not mere assistants. Christine Roper has a CPA and an MBA, and Ms. Harper testified that it's her standard practice, like many other forensic firms, to assign 2 to 3 key accountants to each case and then to utilize, for additional quality control purposes, other members of the staff. She testified that in the over 100 times she has testified in court, none of her fees that were billed by other members of her firm have ever been cut.
Was that an issue in the Valentine case?
It was not directly addressed on point by Your Honors Jones and Daly in the Valentine case. However, Ms. Harper did testify that at the trial court level, her bills were looked at, and they did include, as they do in every case where she endorses an expert, billing by other members of her firm. She also testified, and Your Honor, Judge Jones brought up a good point, that the net effect of her not doing this would be to increase the costs that any party experiences from its expert. It's a typical analogy, like a law firm. It's, you know, fee shifting. You have the partners who bill at a higher rate doing some of the work, and then the associates billing at a lower rate in order to be a cost saver to the client. It's exactly what Ms. Harper's firm does here. It's exactly what most forensic expert firms do, and it keeps costs down. So if we're looking at the burden of cost shifting, this is a cost-saving measure.
Well, it seems like there were times when they were billing for being at the same meeting or the same consultation at the same time. In that situation, she wouldn't be billing more because she was there. She was already being accounted for as one of the billing principals.
Your Honor, there was one meeting that was referenced in the briefing where Ms. Roper and Ms. Harper both attended right before trial. And I think it was just under 4 hours. And during that meeting, Ms. Harper was present to help prepare the examination questioning, and Ms. Roper was there to listen to the facts and the questions that she needed to then translate into demonstrative exhibits. So they were working on different tasks at the same time. And so I would submit, Your Honors, that is the only instance where they both appeared at the same meeting, and at that meeting, they were both performing separate tasks. So there was no double billing in that instance.
Counsel, what is your position on whether the issue of the existence of a bright line rule barring recovery for costs for assistance was raised and argued below?
At the hearing on the bill of costs, Ms. Harper was questioned about the time that was billed by her staff members. And in the briefing, the appellants did argue that this time that was billed by other members that did not testify. However, they never raised the issue of whether or not the hourly rates charged by those other members of Ms. Harper's firm were reasonable. And that's what the trial court was charged with considering, is whether the rates were reasonable and whether the number of hours charged were necessary. And the trial court's decision was based on ample evidence and binding precedent that these fees were recoverable by the prevailing party in this matter.
Well, I guess my question was that there would be two ways of challenging the reasonableness of fees or costs for the assistants. One would be they spent too much time or their hourly rate is too high. The other would be, as a matter of law, they're simply not recoverable. Okay. I'm asking you what your position as to whether the second argument was raised below.
Yes, and the trial court addressed that in his detailed order awarding the costs, and the trial court said that there is no statute or no rule that would compel him to deviate from precedent, that there's nothing that says only the testifying expert's fees must be recovered. There's no statute in Colorado setting forth such a bright line rule. As I stated, the cases that the defendants have cited are distinguishable because they fall under a different statute.
So what's the precedent that says the costs are awardable? I mean, if the court says it's not going to go contrary to the precedent, I guess you say there's no case holding they're not recoverable. What's the case holding that they are recoverable?
We have all the cases cited in our brief.
For the
Cherry Creek, we have, well, they don't
for the assistance. The
I would acknowledge, Your Honor, that there is a dearth of case law specifically addressing whether or not other members of an expert firm's time is recoverable, but it falls within the sound discretion of a trial court whose discretion is quite broad. In this case, he heard ample evidence. And Ms. Harper, she occupied over 38 pages of the trial transcript. She was questioned at length about these bills, and the trial judge carefully considered this ample evidence in coming to a very recent decision to award these costs.
So it sounds like it would just then be up to the trial court under an abuse of discretion standard to determine reasonableness. And where I, the concern that I have then with you acknowledging that there's a dearth of case law, you have eight people involved here, some more involved than others, but it sounded like that Ms. Roper's job was to review it to make sure that substantively the report was correct, and somebody else reviewed it, took out their calculator to make sure that mathematically it was correct, and then what happens at the next case, somebody's going to check their work to make sure that it's substantively correct or mathematically correct. I mean, are we then just to look at the trial court's opinion, and if the trial court thinks that that's reasonable, then that long list of assistants all comes in?
I see Your Honor's point. In this case, the trial court had an opportunity to question exactly how each one of those eight billers contributed to Ms. Harper's report in preparation for trial. And only 3.9 hours of that entire time was billed by someone who did not have a CPA. Ms. Roper did not merely review the report. She performed calculations. She performed what we call data mining, going through thousands of pages of financial documents, as did Ms. Harper. It was a collaborative team. These so-called assistants have CPAs and MBAs. They themselves, Ms. Roper herself is a testifying expert. So the trial court had the opportunity to examine Ms. Harper about each one of these individuals and to determine that the time that they spent was reasonable and necessary and contributed strongly to the plaintiff's success in this matter. The defendants didn't even call their experts after Ms. Harper testified. That's how effective her testimony was, and that's how instrumental her time was in this case. And compared to the time that the defendant's experts had billed, her hours were extremely reasonable. By the point of their counting expert Lisa Muir's deposition, prior to her deposition, she testified she had already billed the defendants $40,000 to $50,000. That's $40,000 to $50,000 before she even had her deposition taken. Melinda Harper billed a total of $90,000, including her time for writing two rebuttal reports, being deposed, preparing for trial, and her trial attendance. And the plaintiffs also made the very frugal decision to retain Ms. Harper to serve the dual role of responding to both of defendants' experts. In all ways, the plaintiffs took measures to curb their costs when it came to their expert fees. And I would respect that the trial court's decision to award those fees was based on ample evidence and case law that's very strong in both Valentine and the cases cited therein. I'd like to move on to the other costs, or unless the court has further questions about the expert fees. Okay. The next charge of an abuse of discretion that the defendants raised regards the $6,600 in copy costs that the court awarded the plaintiffs. Defendants argue that 6 cents per page would have been a reasonable cost, and cite the Valentine case for that proposition. However, as your honors know, the issue in the Valentine case when it came to copy charges was whether or not there was any profit enjoyed in the in-house copy charges. And this court remanded to the trial court to consider whether or not the 20 cents per page that was being charged to Mountain States actually included an element of profit to the law firm. Here, the court does not have to take that step, because the trial court heard from Catherine McKenzie, who is the accountant at White & Steel, about the fact that there was no profit made in that 17 cents per copy that White & Steel incurred. She analyzed all of the copying documents and came to the conclusion that, in fact, the law firm was losing money at the time on that 17 cents per charge. In addition, the plaintiffs brought Shay Thurman, an outside copy vendor who has extensive experience in the copy industry. Ms. Thurman analyzed all of the invoices for the copying. In addition, she brought with her to the hearing a stack of budget and pricing quotes from other law firms and other outside copy vendors. Based on this analysis, she testified during the hearing that White & Steel's in-house copy costs of 17 cents per page is actually commensurate with the industry and low compared to many firms. She did a similar analysis, looking at what other copy firms would charge, including two copy price plans that were presented by the defendant's counsel, Greenberg Traylor. She looked at these and she stated that the outside copy charges incurred by the plaintiffs in this case, by the outside vendor called Impact Legal, were commensurate and even competitive in the industry. Ms. Thurman testified that she herself had not been able to get any work for her company at White & Steel because Impact Legal's charges are so competitive that the firm refuses to look at another vendor. Therefore, the charges for the copies in this case were reasonable. Defendants raised the difference between performing inside and outside copying. And as Your Honor pointed out, often it's just not practical to send copy jobs to an outside vendor. In this case, the outside vendor, Impact Legal, is several blocks away. There has to be enough time to coordinate a phone call, time for them to get to our building, to get instructions from the paralegal or the secretary, and then to send the copying out. You could only get the copy job back in the same day if you pay double charges. In addition, the 6 cents charge that defendants refer to is for what you call a blowback copy. As Ms. Thurman explained, that's when you take a CD, insert it into a computer, and hit print. There's no work to be done, and that's why it's so inexpensive. Wendy Garfio, the paralegal for plaintiff's firm, testified at the bill of costs hearing. And she testified that in most of the instances when in-house copying was performed, the decision to do it in-house was based on the fact that those copy jobs would have required additional steps that Impact Legal would have charged considerably more than 6 cents. In fact, they would have called it heavy litigation, and the charge would have been between 15 and 18 cents per page. These extra steps include removing staples, hole punching, binders, flags, indexes. All of these things were performed in-house because the plaintiffs were trying to contain their costs. Based on this evidence, what the trial court heard from Ms. Garfio, that this was a very document-intensive case. There were thousands of pages of documents produced. The general ledgers from the defendants alone were over 1,000 pages long. Each of these documents had to be copied and processed, often face labeled for production, and unfortunately it was expensive. But the measures that the plaintiffs took kept these costs considerably lower than they otherwise would have been if they had sent everything to the outside vendor. Next and finally, I'd like to talk about the issue of the deposition transcripts. Like the other three areas of costs, this is an enumerated cost in 1316.122,
Does 1316.122 talk about depositions only for the perpetuation of testimony?
Actually, Your Honor, it states the cost of any court reporter or transcript necessary for perpetuation of testimony.
Perpetuation of testimony?
Exactly. And this distinction that the defendants have come up with of taking a deposition versus defending a deposition, it doesn't appear anywhere in a statute or in a case. And there was no reason for the trial court to abandon all the prior precedent, including the Valentine case and all the cases you cited in there, that say costs for discovery depositions are recoverable as long as the requesting party provides sufficient documentation to support those costs.
Why are they necessary for perpetuation of the testimony? Why were these depositions necessary for perpetuation of the testimony?
Well, these depositions weren't just of ancillary fact witnesses. These were of the plaintiffs themselves and their witness. And so in order to prepare the plaintiffs and the expert witness for their depositions, the copies of the transcripts were necessary to be reviewed, to prepare direct examination questions.
Is that what perpetuation of their testimony means within the meaning of the cost statute?
Your Honor, there has been no case law cited in this case that would indicate otherwise. That the statute that gives the broad discretion to the trial court to award costs related to transcripts as set forth in Valentine states that there is this discretion to recover costs related to discovery depositions. It says discovery depositions. There's no distinction made for perpetuation.
That's right. Was that a case or was that the statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was that a case that didn't make the distinction, or was it the statute that didn't make the distinction?
The case did not make the distinction, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honors, let me respond to a couple of the points made. First, counsel mentioned with respect to experts that the statutory site that I've been referencing throughout, and we reference in our briefs, 1333.102, is not at issue here. Respectfully, her statement that only 1316.122 on costs is relevant overlooks the fact that subsection E of that statute expressly refers you to 1333.102, charges for expert witnesses approved pursuant to 1333.102. 1333.102 in turn provides for recovery only as to a testifying expert. Counsel indicated that only one of the individuals amongst the assistants here did not have a CPA. And I think she meant that to be impressive. I am concerned by the thought that the way in which Ms. Harper has developed her billing and preparation is to acquire a team full of CPAs who would otherwise be consulting non-testifying experts for whom a party could not recover expenses and sweep them within a it takes a village view of expert testifying such that now she can recover all of their fees. The statute doesn't provide for that. When counsel says that there's a dearth of cases, both Perkins and Western Fire Truck expressly say assistants are not covered. There is not a dearth of cases. Those cases cover it. Western Fire Truck was a recent appeal, and in that appeal, the assistant that wasn't covered was John Butler, who was in fact another economist. With respect to copying, I'm out of time. Thank you.
Counsel, I want to thank you for respecting the time limits. We have more attorneys than you know that would bluff right through that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Counsel, I appreciate your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our docket for today, and the court will be in recess, and the bailiff will so announce.
We have one more case, actually.
Well, that does not conclude our docket for today. But thank you very much for your arguments. Maybe we'll get another judge to sit on this third case.
Thank you, Your Honor.